I sure hope this helps someone. It hurts all over again to know that there's someone out there feeling the way I felt. It's interesting. I was thinking how I would start this, and about a year after my attempt, I started trying to write the story of how it happened, because that's always been how I've dealt with things, is to talk about it out loud in a story. And I found that I couldn't. I couldn't even write the words without getting choked up and without having a little panic attacks. And I had told parts of it to the two therapists I've been going to for that whole year. But I hadn't told anyone really the whole story, in sequence. And I would be just writing this in my journal, and I would get choked up, and I'd get upset because it meant I wasn't through it as far as I wanted to be. And then I'd get worried because at some point, for me, it's important to say it on stage. You know, that's the next step for pulling the claws out, you know? And I thought, I can't even say it in my living room alone without getting choked up and crying. How am I gonna say this in front of strangers? So I was trying to think of I got that story out finally, and I told it, and it's really good for me. But I've never told it just personally all the way to one person without it. So I wasn't sure how I wanted to say it, but what was surprising is today as I was driving down here is that that date, December 1st, 2012, is burned into my memory more deeply than my birthday. I can barely remember my birthday, but that date I think about a lot because it was so terrifying. Even in retrospect, it still scares me to think that I could get to that place. And even though I'm almost 2 years past it, and I've done a lot of work, I'm really happy where my life is now in ways that I could not even imagine 2 years ago. But that night still is still very scary. And one of the things that makes it less scary is just talking about it, but in a purposeful way. It's not part of my chit-chat at work on the elevator on the way up, you know, to the third floor. It's just, if I can talk about it to people who need to hear it, it makes it less scary for me. Basically, what happened is I was in a relationship with a woman for 7 years, and then off and on for another year after that. And the night I realized it was over for good, it was the night I saw her. I found out she had a boyfriend. Everything just fell out from under me that night. I was trapped in a room with him. I couldn't leave immediately, and I didn't know she would be at this place. And then this guy walked in, and it was clear that she had found someone, and I had to be in this room with him for 20 minutes before I could escape. I could not get out. And I drove home and tried to end my life. And it was so... The memory of that night being so out of control is, I guess it's good that it's still scary a little bit, because it keeps me doing the things I need to do every day, every day. I've had depression all my life. I've known that since I was a kid. I couldn't put words to it, but I just knew that this is bad. I'm not coping with this well. I had a mom who's a very, very angry woman. And my dad left when I was 10, and so I was trapped with this woman who just screamed at me every day. And so nothing was ever safe. I was never safe in the one place where I should have been safe. And so I grew up always wondering why other people were happy. Like, what does that feel like? I was trying to think of an analogy to express how I felt, how it feels to... I hate meeting people who love their parents. Because it's like, what are you? What kind of person? I mean, I'm jealous, but at the same time, I'm like, fuck you. Like, who are you? Does that exist? And I don't have this. All my life, I felt like being around those people is like, I feel like I'm a penguin raised by eagles. Right? I'm just, everyone around me is soaring majestically, and I'm just flapping around trying not to get eaten by a sea lion or a fucking orca. And I'm like, I don't even know I'm a penguin. I'm like a shitty eagle. I'm like, what, how does that, how do you, the wings? How do you get, I'm trying really hard. Damn it. I had no idea there was such a thing as a penguin, you know? So, I go through life like this, just wondering, like, why am I so unhappy? And I realized during my recovery this past year and a half that I've looked to other people to make me happy. Women, basically. And it seems, you know, in some way that seems logical. Like, everyone says, well, I want someone to make me happy. But you don't realize, well, you kind of have to be halfway happy first. That's a lot to put on someone if you're their reason, they're your reason for you know, joy. So I grew up probably like most people thinking, I didn't realize that you had to work to be happy. You had to do something. I remember sitting on the couch a few months ago thinking about that phrase, I want to be happy. And then I thought, oh, to be is a verb. I need to do something. I have to in order to be, I have to do things that make me happy, that bring happiness. And I had been doing those things because I was following, you know, my directions from my doctor and my therapist and my aunt, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't, I thought I was just doing the things that were prescribed for me, exercise and get sleep and eat healthy. And I didn't realize that for the rest of my life, it's going to involve doing things. I can't wish I was happy. I have to find things that are important to me and then do them. And that, whew, that's huge, man. I never in a million years... It's, I don't know why they don't teach us that in high school. I mean, who cares about algebra? Like, I've never used that. But just telling a kid you need to do things. If you're unhappy, it's, you know, there are things to do. It's work. And one of the things that really saved me was going to AA. I've never had a drug or alcohol problem. I've never done drugs, and alcohol is not a problem for me, but I went to this meeting because I just knew I had to go. And because my therapist had been talking about addiction and things like that, even though I didn't have a substance abuse problem. We were talking about emotional addictions, so it was on my mind. And then I found this meeting, and that first meeting was it was a bunch of people talking about what they did to be happy, to not sink into whatever problems they had. It was all, for me, if I just substituted the word depression for alcohol, it made perfect sense. And I'd never seen people treat each other with like that kind of forgiveness. And and empathy. And I'm just stunned. Like, and then I read these steps. I go home and I read these things, and I thought, well, I'll try to do them. I'll try to do these steps. I'll just substitute depression for alcohol. And it was kind of life or death. Like, I knew that I ain't gonna be around another year if I don't find something to physically do. It can't be all up in my head, because this is the thing that got me there. Mm-hmm. I need something, you know, the brain that got you into this situation is rarely the brain that's gonna get you out. Yeah. And so I just followed these steps, and they were things that I had to do. I had to say things, I had to write things down, I had to take certain actions. And I was so, it's not that I still didn't want to die. It's just that I didn't want to give up not having done my best at that point. I just thought, I want to go down swinging. And I wasn't really scared of failing. I just didn't want to embarrass myself, you know? And it started working. I didn't tell anyone I was going to these meetings because it would have been weird. Everyone knew that I rarely drank anyway. And I mean, I was scared to drink because I know it's a depressant. And I thought, well, it's not that I'm going to crash my car. It's that I'm going to crash emotionally. I can't have any depressant in my life. And for me, that seemed to be a way of being in that group and somehow qualifying, you know? Mm-hmm. And I still haven't told most people because it's just too weird for them. But it has helped me more than I ever thought it would. And I was talking to, I run a storytelling show in Seattle, called Fresh Ground Stories. And this rabbi came out to it once. It's just an open mic. You know, anyone can get up and tell a true story about their life. And this rabbi, he was Hasidic with the curls and the big hat and the Jew duster, the big black coat and the whole thing. And I missed that. Like, my mom was Jewish, but not like super Jew, just like, you know, Jew-ish. But I wasn't raised that way. I always thought, well, let's be more Jewy. This seems more interesting than what we are. But I didn't grow up around any Jews. So this guy walks in and he tells a story, and he's like right out of the Old Testament. He just hypnotizes all of us. It's amazing. And he came up to me after show. We were talking, and I said, you know, we decided we would get to know each other. And at some point, he was asking me about how Jewish I was. And I said, well, you know, I didn't grow up with that religion, but I have just recently started praying. And he said, oh, that's great. And I said, well, AA taught me to pray. Mm-hmm. And He was like shocked, like he'd never even, yet he was hard for him to conceive of that. But it's true, like I haven't prayed in 30 years since my mom died when I was 17. That was the end of it. And I was very much anti-praying and anti-anything, any spiritual. It just seemed like I'd been abandoned by that too. You know, from 17 on, my mom died, I couch surfed for years till I just got my feet under me, you know? And so those things I got to remind myself to do, that it's still strange going to 12-step meetings when I don't have a substance abuse problem. I don't advertise that while I'm there, but it's one of the many things that have surprised me in the last 2 years after my attempt, that I had no idea was out there, you know? It seems strange to be this old and learning these things, because I just assumed that it would never get better. When I was recovering that first year and a half, I guess I figured maybe I'll live, maybe I won't, maybe I'll have a few more years in me, but I can't see suddenly learning to enjoy life, you know? And it wasn't until I started talking about my attempt that I realized maybe I had something to live for. And I'm saying that as a parent. Like, the thought of leaving my son without a father was not enough for me to put the razor down. And that's a terrible feeling to have as a parent. That's why I kind of get upset when people say that suicide is an act of cowardice and selfishness, because, you know, first of all, it's really fucking hard to kill yourself. Like, it's not something you just, like, it takes a lot of half-assed attempts and a lot of, you know, months or years of ideation to even get to the point where you can step out on that bridge. And you know, nobody puts a gun in their mouth or a razor to their wrist or steps to the edge of a bridge for fun. I mean, you really, you've gone, when you get to that point where you're just moments away from pulling a trigger or taking one step, that's really serious. And it's not selfish at all. It's, you wouldn't have someone in pain, you know, cancer, was never going to be healthy, to stick around for you. That's what I want to tell people. Like, if you were dying in pain and there was no help for you, you would want to just ease yourself out of this life. You wouldn't want me telling you, oh, it would hurt me if you died. You stay in pain so I can feel better. Like, that's a shitty thing to say. And it's such a cliche for people to say that. I heard a friend of mine tell a story about his suicide attempt, and he called himself selfish. And I was so mad at him. And I love this guy. He just said it because those words have been pushed into our brain for so many years. But I wanted to say, it's okay. You were in so much pain. You just wanted it to end, man. You weren't being selfish. You were taking care of yourself. And the only way you could think in that moment. And so That is a phrase I wish I could just erase from this language, that it's cowardly or selfish. I just, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, the reason I'm here is that I know that it helps me when I talk about this. And I don't know how much I should talk about it. I don't want to talk about it if it helps people. I want someone to know that you're probably standing in line next to someone at the bank who has been through this. And I want you to know that you're not alone. But I'm nervous that people will think I'm just doing this for attention. And it's hard to explain to people who don't write or don't express themselves artistically, how important it is to get this stuff out in your art. Like, it was really hard to tell that story on stage of exactly what happened. But it's one of the few times in my life where I got to be completely honest without having to worry about someone else's feelings. Like, it was just for me. And I just wanted to make something beautiful out of the worst time in my life. I tried so hard to make something meaningful and beautiful out of it, because I couldn't think of it as that bad thing anymore. I just had to think, there's got to be a positive side to this. I got to make something good out of this. And, you know, I do that through writing and telling stories. And so that's the only way I could do it. And, it was, I guess it's the first half of, it was like the end of the first half of my recovery. I had this feeling, I had this vague feeling that the second half of my recovery is when, or if I get in a relationship again. Because that's usually, that's what triggers all these things. And, I don't know how I'm going to react the next time I get my heart broken. I'm better now. I'm better. I have more tools and I'm stronger than I've ever been. But that's the trial by fire right there, man. That's the emotional gang initiation that I'm going to have to go through. The past is just beating me with rocks and sticks. It's when I'm in a relationship, it's like we're both flying a plane. And then when we break up, it's like the plane disappears, but I'm the only one without a parachute. It seems like everyone else just floating down, we got this, and I'm just plummeting, and I can't, like, where did you get that parachute? Did you get on the plane with that? Or did I just miss it? It's really scary. I mean, I started dating a little bit, and I've broken up with more women in the last few months than I have in my entire life. My entire, put together. Because I like, no, if I'm not putting up with any craziness because I can't handle that right now. And I suppose in some ways that's good because in the past I would have just blown past all the red flags and thought, no, I can fix this. I got this. No problem. I just need someone to love me. And it's really important for me to learn how to be happy alone. And I never, ever thought I could be happy alone. I always thought it would just be biding my time. And I guess I'm practicing that. I feel like I have to hit the emotional gym every day to be strong enough to get through the periods where it's just me. And I go many years between girlfriends. Like, I've never been able to jump from person to person to keep me afloat. I'm always in the process of sinking in the chest before I sink, you know, someone comes along and I go, ah. Okay. And so I can't do that anymore. And I didn't think at 47 I'd have to learn that. Do you have to go out?
No. Nope.
Okay.
Just getting comfortable.
Before I told my story on stage, I had to talk to my son about it. He didn't know what I'd gone through. He's 23, he wasn't living with me at the time. And so about a year and a half after that night, I had to tell him because I can't go tell strangers without telling my son, you know. And I was terrified, like, how do I bring this up? What's he gonna think of me? How do we begin this? And I took him out for a drive and I thought, I gotta do this. I need to get it over. I can't. Most of my life I thought, you know, you gotta keep secrets like that from your children. They don't need to know everything about you. But I also knew that if I'm gonna talk to other people about this because I wanna help them, because I wanna be of service, then my son has to at least know what I'm doing. And so somehow the subject came up. He had a cousin who left a suicide note, and they got to her before she did anything. But it was this just perfect opening for me to talk about it. And he thankfully was really understanding. And he wasn't angry at me. He was happy about how hard I've been working to in recovery. And and I got to say, I think it was really important for me to say to my son, this is how we get through things. We make something good out of something terrible. And this is how your dad does it, you know. But you can't keep the bad thing in the bad place. You got to bring it out and work with it. And I don't think I could have ever explained that to him if I hadn't lived through it. If I hadn't, it would all just be an intellectual exercise. And part of me wishes I didn't have to have this horrible thing happen to get that stuff. Like everything I'm doing now, I know exercise is good for my depression. I know that eating healthy is good. I know that getting off my couch and talking to people about anything is healthy, right? But it was never important enough to do those things until I woke up every day going, well, am I going to kill myself today? Do I want to go into that? Do I want to experience that level of terror again? Because if I don't, maybe you should get on the treadmill. Maybe you should do a few push-ups. And I get all gushy at the gym now. I want to hug my trainer every day. Like, you don't know what you mean to me. Do it to me. Make me lift more. I don't care. 1,000 burpees. Let's do this. Yeah, those are horrible. She's like, why do you always show up? You don't understand.
I have to.
I should have my health insurance pay for this gym membership, man. It's funny. I'm stronger physically and emotionally than I've ever been. But I also know that I haven't tested myself yet.
You're still training.
I'm still training, man. The Olympics is probably a couple years away. I don't, I wonder if the memory of that night will ever stop scaring me. I wonder. I haven't talked to... I've only talked to one other person who had an attempt that I know well enough to talk to about it. Or I guess two other people. And I've never asked them that. I just learned that they were attempt survivors at my from my show. I've been running that show for almost 2 years before my attempt. And then after my attempt, it's monthly. It was the only day of the month I looked forward to. So I'd have 29 days of just absolute despair and agony. And then I would try to find any reason not to drive up to Seattle and bring the amp and the microphone and go to this coffee shop that gives us a little room. And I thought, I can't do this. But once I'd get there, these people would tell these amazing stories of things they'd lived through. And some of them were way worse than I'll ever live through. And I would... It'd be so beautiful for an hour and a half, 2 hours of people just coming together and talking about how they live through these things they never thought they could live through. And then they would thank me for creating the space and driving up all the way from Olympia to do this. I'd be like, how can I not now? I didn't realize how much that show meant to me, how in some ways, it's still the best day of the month for me when I get to talk to just survivors of life, man. It's so beautiful what those people walk up and say into that microphone. And most of them I've never seen before. They're not my friends. I mean, they might be my friends afterward, but... To see those people sharing like that, because they desperately need to. The other day someone said, you know, this show feels a lot like an AA meeting. And I thought, it is a lot like an AA meeting, except they serve alcohol here. That's the big difference. It's a coffee shop that serves wine and beer, and I'm not drinking any of it, but it's kind of, it has that support group vibe, but it's not, it's just people. I didn't realize how much I'd grown toward that, people sharing these incredibly honest stories of surviving something. And in some ways, you know, some of those people up there are, they're up there, they're crying, they're shaking. Maybe they've never spoken in front of an audience before in their lives. And as sad as they are sometimes remembering these memories, there's this, I feel this joy that they're there. They're sharing it with me. And all these other strangers, like all of a sudden everyone feels really safe and just loved in that moment. And I never felt that growing up. There wasn't a day in my life I felt that. And that really sucks. That sucks, you know? That's the one place you should feel safe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for most of my life, I've thought about, you know, that I ruminate on these old memories of growing up, and then I think, well, you know, I wasn't beaten. I wasn't sexually assaulted. I mean, there, you know, there are so many people who had it way worse. But it did what it did to me, you know? It made me believe the world is not a safe place. And there's not an ounce of love extra out there for me. I grew up thinking one mistake can destroy you. And I can't live like that anymore. I gotta have faith. And for years, you know, I didn't realize this. I'd been asking my friends how they found faith. I had a friend, one of my best friends, became a Lutheran minister. And I asked him, like, how did you find this faith in God and anything? Mm-hmm. And he didn't have a good answer for me. He just, like, got it. And I would go around just kind of poking at people, like, so what's, I want to know. I wasn't trying to derail them. I really wanted to know. And they looked at me like I, you know, was crazy. And then I said to my therapist, maybe 6 months after my attempt, I said, you know, a lot of this comes down to faith. I have nothing to believe in. Remember once I wanted to write an essay for This I Believe, and I realized I had nothing positive that I believed in. I believed negative things were going to happen. I couldn't find one thing that I believed in that was a positive. And it was like, oh, what? This is horrible. So I said, if I can't find faith in whatever, a higher power, whatever you want to call it, anything, nature, art, God, whatever, I'm not going to make it. I mean, that's one of the big steps of AA is find, you know, believe in something greater than yourself, even if it's just the group. And he said something that I can't believe no one ever said before. It was one of those things where you go, really? He said, faith is a choice. You don't find it. You know, you choose to have faith, because if you're looking for proof, you're not going to find it. And it would be a fact. If you could prove it, then it wouldn't be faith. You can't have faith without doubt. So you just decide to have it. I couldn't believe no one had ever said that. I mean, all the people of faith I know try to prove to me, they try to give me proof that I should have faith in a higher power. Mm-hmm. And you can't. So they always sounded ridiculous to me. So every day now I can do this thing where I can choose to have faith. I'm trying hard to be grateful that I found it out at found that out at 47 and not 17. Seems like that would have turned my life around if I'd found that at 17, you know? But no one said it. And if I can say, if I had one thing to say to anyone who was in pain, I would say that faith is a choice. And sometimes it seems like an impossible choice because you can't see how things are going to be better. But you just decide every day to choose it and just give yourself that day. That's what I had to do, man. That one day at a time thing. No, sometimes it was 1 hour at a time. I could not see any goodness in life. But I kept thinking, I really like my therapist. He's a smart dude. And he says faith is a choice. And I've never, ever, ever thought of it that way. So let me just give that a chance. Well, I'll give that a chance today. And the more as I cracked open little by little, day by day, in that year after that terrible night, people would come up and just love on me. I could honestly say now my life is filled with love. And I've never said that before, even when I was in a relationship. I can never say my life is filled with love. The other day I said something just ridiculous. Just like I almost, it was as though I started speaking in tongues. I said, suddenly, if someone asked me how I'm doing, I said, you know, I'm pretty lucky. Like, what? I've never said those words, not even in like Monopoly, like no game. I could be playing blackjack and have 21. I mean, I could win $1,000. I still wouldn't say I'm. How did those words? Yeah, I'm a pretty lucky guy. I don't know what I was thinking. I've never said those words in my life. And there are days when I truly do not feel lucky. When it is a slog, when I think, right, did I take my meds? Am I isolating myself? Did I not go to the gym? Did I, whatever. I mean, there are days when it feels like, you know, luck is not in the room. But just the fact that I said that, I got to remember those times more than I have to remember the other times. And right now, it's, I just gotta remember to keep doing all those things. I gotta remember not to let people in my life that trigger me. Like, you know, my ex-girlfriend and I love each other very much, but I can't see her. You know, I can't. If I saw her in the grocery store, I'd have to leave. Because it's not safe for me yet. And it's frustrating when friends will say, they'll imply that I should be over it. And that I shouldn't go out of my way to go to the other side of town to go shopping. But they weren't there in that room with that razor. And they don't know that I haven't thrown that razor away yet. I realized I hadn't thrown it away a few weeks ago. And I had this daydream that maybe some woman would come into my life and I'd tell her the story and she'd throw it away for me. And I thought, no, I gotta throw it away. I can't ask someone else to do that. I have to want to stick around enough that I throw it away. So it's important to remember that I haven't thrown that away yet. But I think I'll know when the time is right. I have a feeling I'll know when I can do that. Every day I get closer to it, but I know if I throw it away too soon, it won't work. You know, I'll figure out a way to bring it back into my life. So it's hidden away in a place I can't get to it. And I'm glad I didn't realize that I hadn't thrown it away before now. I mean, it was just this week when I realized, oh, wow, that's still there. What do I do with it? And then it was very clear that I wasn't ready to do that because I'm not... I'm still training. You know, I'm not ready for the show. I'm not ready for the... not ready for the opening night. Still rehearsing. But it's pretty awesome that I don't know where it is in the house. Like, I think about it so little. I'm not scared to walk by a certain closet or a certain drawer. Like, I just kind of know it's there and I'll deal with it when it's... when I'm ready. And I don't want anyone else throwing it away for me. I have a friend, if she knew, she would throw it away for me. I think I'd be very angry at her. So. Boy, I sure hope this helps someone. It hurts all over again to know that there's someone out there feeling the way I felt a year and a half ago.
You know, it's interesting. Someone is taking a crisis call right now. I don't know if you...
Is that what they're doing out there?
Yeah, this is a hotline.
I wondered if I didn't want to ask, but I'm like...
And I just overheard it. So you're saying this, and he's saying, are you in a safe place?
Oh.
And it's like some weird kind of magic.
Wow. Ay, ay, ay.
It's pretty crazy, huh?
Whoa.
This is a weird day.
It is. It is. You know what's... strange at work. I just got a promotion yesterday at work after 8.5 years.
Oh shit, awesome.
Yeah, it was really like, I've had this great job where I'm just absolutely beloved at work. I just feel so blessed that people...
I don't see how.
But here's the thing.
You're the best.
So I got, here's the thing. So I'm in this mode where I got to do things that scare me, right? Like I don't want to... Courage is so important to me. I was writing a list of things I want in a partner in the future, and courage was like right up the top of the list because it's a big deal in my life. Like, I have to show courage every day in some little way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always looking for extra things to do at work. I work in an agency where we help people build homeless shelters and domestic violence shelters and low-income housing and we have a unit that's a victim advocacy, mostly sexual assault. And so I'm always volunteering to go like into a homeless shelter and do like, maybe I'll do a little radio story to get their people's voices and on our website and see how we're like a success story of some sort. And I'm always looking for, I'm the guy people call when they're homeless and they need to know where the nearest shelter is or whatever. And so I was running out of these extra things to do. I didn't have any more. And We just got this new program called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. That it's now officially against the law to rape someone in prison. Yeah. So.
Not against the law.
Yeah. Well, it's not a popular law. And prison's not really into it because it forces them to investigate. There's a line you can call and leave a message saying, I'm being sexually harassed or whatever.
How do you call it?
It's an 800 number. You can call it from prison. And it's the PREA line. And states, until recently, have not bothered installing it because the federal government, they passed the law but didn't like enforce it. Well, now, 10 years later, they're like, oh, you guys should do something. We're going to start auditing you to make sure you have a line. So so we just got the program, and I volunteered to answer it. Because, like, as soon as I heard it was terrifying. I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm like, but because so many people I've been in love with have experienced that sexual assault, I wanted to know how to help. I wanted to know what it was about. Like, it never kept me from being with someone, but I knew that I was way out of my league as far as how to deal with someone who's had that kind of trauma in their life. So I offered to answer the prison rape hotline. And I got all this training, like 30, 40 hours of training. And it was brutal. Just the training was brutal. And then going back and thinking about all the women I've loved who have experienced that. It was so important for me to say, okay, I want to help someone, even if it's a prisoner. If I'm going to say there are no bad victims, then I got to walk the talk. It's fucking scary. Because those people are never in a safe place. That's what reminded me. Like, I can't say, are you in a safe place? Because mm-hmm. they're not. I can't put them in another prison. I can't. Yeah. And mostly, you know what? It's guards.
Yep.
It's not prisoner on prisoner. And it's so hard to listen to somebody saying, I don't know what to do. They're always there. I never would have done that. I never would have offered to help on that line if I hadn't truly known what hopelessness and helplessness were like. To have sympathy even for a prisoner. Like, I never thought I'd have sympathy for, you know, a felon, maybe a violent felon. I don't know what their crimes are. I don't want to know. Don't ask. Like, I don't know why. I want to know why you're in. Let's just get through this period. I never would have said, I'll help answer this crisis line. If I hadn't gone through that night.